Welcome to episode 66 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson, Michael Lucas Smith, and Dave Buck. This week we had a guest, Craig Latta, on the show who talked about Spoon, his project to make Squeak into a smaller, more modular Smalltalk, somewhat related to the work that Alan Wurzbach did years ago at Park Place Digidoc and before that at Digidoc, but in more of an imperative style as opposed to declarative. In any case, I'll let Craig explain that during the podcast. This is a two-part episode, so come back next week for part two. In the meantime, if you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com or head on over to iTunes, Facebook, Podcast Alley, or the Small Talkers group on Ning.
Darling, I gotta talk to you about the things you've been putting me through now. I gotta talk to you, I gotta be explained to you.
Who's on?
Craig's here.
David's here.
And Michael says call in progress. Is your mic on?
Hello, testing.
Oh, there he is. He probably didn't have batteries in his headphones.
We have to have one of the two of you has to have your audio screwed up each week. It's a tradition.
I think Parallels was still, you know, chewing up memory after I quit Civ 4.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it's always some game.
No, it's always Civ 4.
So, Craig, you're here too?
Yes.
You hear me? And I trust everybody got the document that Craig pointed to on his website?
Yes, I have it with me.
Actually, can we just have Craig say hello and then Dave say hello?
Hey there, it's Craig.
Hi there, it's Dave.
Wow, really similar. Voices
That's
are quite
scary.
Yeah.
You've never seen a photo of us at the same time, yeah.
I haven't actually seen the two of them in the same place at the same time, so.
How do you know where this not the same person?
That's right. So, Craig, I guess we might as well get started talking about, well, the topic at hand being your work on Spoon. So why don't you go back a little bit and just get us started with your Smalltalk history.
Oh, wow. So I was introduced to Smalltalk at UC Berkeley in the music department back in 1990. There were some people there using it for doing music stuff. In particular, a guy named Guy Garnett. Was using it to do a follower system, expert system, for some conducting work that he was doing. I can't remember which version of Smalltalk they had there. I think it was ObjectWorks 2. And anyway, he just was telling me about how cool it was, and so I started playing around with it. And at roughly the same time, I was working in a student research group there at Berkeley called the XCF, and they just happened to have a copy of the Blue Book on their shelf. And so I just, you know, started reading that too, and was you know, thoroughly captivated by it. And I guess maybe about 9 months later, I saw an ad from Glenn Krasner on the net, I think in a local jobs Usenet group, ba.jobs, you know, saying they were looking for someone to help out with the VM stuff. So I applied for that and worked at Park Place for a while, and that was sort of my beginning.
Now, just out of curiosity, when you were at UCB, did you run across Stephen Travis Pope, or is that concurrent with some of his early time there?
Actually, he was at Berkeley after I was there, but yeah, the computer music lab in question is where we both were at different times. CENMAT, the Center for New Music and Audio Technologies.
Okay.
Run by David Wessel. And yeah, so I actually did run into him there. While I was just graduating from Berkeley, a bunch of local small talk and music hackers started talking about, you know, creating a music representation system. And yeah, so I actually got together with Steven and Danny Oppenheim down at Stanford at their music lab, just called Karma, Center for Contemporary Research in Music and Acoustics. And yeah, so I got to know them.
Okay, well, the reason I ask is that we actually had Steven on the last 2 weeks. That podcast isn't out yet, but I talked to him a few weeks ago, actually maybe a month or two ago, and then we talked to him again. So it's just kind of interesting that you mentioned some of the same turf that he mentioned in his pod and when we talked to him.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And Smoke, the small music object kernel, was a name I suggested way back then at those gatherings in 1991.
And that's what's currently become Siren, I guess, over time.
I guess that's part of Siren now.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so moving forward, you've gotten interested in Squeak and some of the shrinking small talk down. So how did Spoon come about? Where did you get started with that?
The prime motivation for that was just how difficult doing team integration had been in all the projects I'd been on before. And it was when I was at Interval Research in around 98. I was there from 96 to 2000. But around in 98, I was just starting to think, you know, I should really do something about this. Of course, I didn't have any time then. Around in 2002, after I left the IBM Watson Center, I had some time to actually do something about this. So I started working on Spoon. And I guess the other main motivation at the time was trying to make the system smaller so that you could download it faster when you're installing it for the first time.
Okay, so you mean, you know, right now if you download, say, VisualWorks, the full ISO is like, actually for VisualWorks and Object Studio, is what is it, Michael? It's now like, what, 560, 580, 600 megabytes?
That's pretty big.
Yeah, and then Squeak is, while it's much smaller, that's mainly because you're downloading an image and a VM and a changes file, so you're not downloading all the ancillary stuff.
Right.
But it's still fairly large, at least in the sense that you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. But I guess I wanted to try to be a little bit clever about it by not just automatically assuming that everyone who's downloading it wants, you know, everything in the kitchen sink, and instead trying to go for some sort of scheme where you download this tiny little program that knows how to get more bits of it if you want them, but it's at least going to ask you about it first. In a way that's hopefully a little more articulate than just a web page.
Was Spoon the original name?
Oh, no. So originally it had a name that I chose to, that was so bad that it would have to be changed, and that name was Squat.
Squat, yeah. I think I remember Squat. Yeah.
And that was sort of funny because, you know, it was like, well, whether I finish it or not, people will get Squat. Yeah.
So then the Matrix came out and there is no Spoon.
Oh, yeah. Well, exactly. So, yeah, there was a nice reference there. There is no Spoon. And then also there are other things in the Matrix, or I guess they ripped it off from Ghost in the Shell, but about people having knowledge sort of imprinted onto their brains. And that sort of harkens to another concept that has since emerged in Spoon.
And then, of course, the real question is, when you use Spoon, are you the big spoon or the little spoon?
Yeah, exactly. And when you're distributing behavior around, are you spoon feeding another system? You know, there are all sorts of great puns you could make.
I don't want to call all our previous guests lazy or anything, but you sent us this very big list of things you wanted to talk about, and it's quite impressive.
Well, you know, we now come to the conclusion of Michael's attempts to be funny.
Just in case there's a lull in the conversation.
Yeah, actually, I did have a question that relates to the problem you bring up, though. Years ago, back when Park Place and Digitalk were doing their ill-fated merger, Alan Wurst-Brock and some of those guys worked on some of their work originally on what they were calling Jigsaw, was declarative small talk and trying to solve some of the same problem. They actually got to the point where they had a small talk image that was, as I recall, either was tens or hundreds of K big, and all it knew how to do was add two numbers. Is what you're doing related at all conceptually to that kind of work?
Yeah, definitely. Although I guess I would say it's stubbornly adhered to having a more imperative outlook on things.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, that very sort of demo was one of the things that I've done along the way.
Yeah, that tiny image is 1,337 bytes, right?
Yeah, and that also just adds 3 and 4 and then quits.
Is that just like a total fluke that it's leaked?
Oh, no. That's another joke. It's actually 1,080 bytes, and I padded it out with zeros to be 1,337.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Just for the joke, yeah. But it's kind of cute. On the Spoon site, netgem.org/spoon, if you look under visualization, people can go and see a picture of every byte of that system. I started realizing after I was getting images smaller than 1024 by 768, which was what my screen was at the time, that hey, I should start doing some visualization stuff. So that's been kind of cute.
So how do you visualize the bytes?
So for that one, that 1337 picture, that's just I decided to make a picture of that snapshot at one moment in time when it first starts up before it actually does anything. So this is where the where Squeak's simulation VM simulator ability comes in really handy. I hacked the simulator to take the object memory that it's holding onto at any moment in time and be able to make pictures from it. So I just decided to give assign a color to every class in the object memory, and then that would determine how I would color each pixel in the picture, and every pixel corresponds to a byte in the object memory.
Okay, I'm looking at that picture online now in your spoon.viz/browser, and until you explained it, I was trying to figure out what in the heck that was other than, I don't know, bad Windows kind of screen failure.
Oh, well, that's another interesting picture. That's sort of also trying to show a little interactive tool I have that goes along with it. You can have the picture on the screen, and then you can also click on different bytes in the picture. And in the transcript, the simulator will tell you, you know, which byte you clicked on and what object it's part of and other little interesting bits of information. But there's another simpler picture that's, like suitable for a T-shirt, which is just the object memory picture and a little tiny legend by way of explanation. There's another link for that.
You've heard of the language PIET, right?
Which one?
PIET. P-I-E-T. It's a graphical. It's a programming language based on pictures.
Oh, okay.
So now I'm wondering what would happen if you ran PIET on your picture here.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
What would it run?
Well, and you know, there are all sorts of arbitrary decisions that went into that picture, like, you know, what should be the aspect ratio of that picture, or should it just be one, you know, 1D sequence of colors, you know. So
now I think specifically for this podcast we should have had a picture ready that all it did was say in audio, "I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that."
Right. Well, and there are other cute things I want to do in the future, like take an object memory in the form of this picture and, you know, use some of the steganographic software floating out there to embed it in another picture and use that picture as, you know, the release mechanism. Like, you know, a picture of the Smalltalk 80 balloon, the byte cover, for example.
Well, actually, I've got kind of a bounding question for the work, and that is that I'm not going to say that I'm trying to denigrate this, because I'm really not, but it's an interesting, it's a question I'd like to hear the answer to, and that is that with disk space becoming close to free and memory becoming close to, not infinite, but you know what I mean, it's getting much larger, how relevant is this kind of shrinkage problem in that kind of environment?
Well, I think where it's most relevant is in the problem of teaching the system to people. The smaller the system is, the more things you can identify as not really essential when you're first teaching the system to someone new learning it, I think the better. The more you can reduce the cognitive load on a new student, I think the better it is. And so a small system really plays into that.
Yeah, that's what I often call the what now problem. When people download either Squeak or VisualWorks non-commercial, they get it open, and I think the problem's equivalent in either one, because they're both fairly big systems, that you have the image sitting there in front of you and you have some set of windows open and you open a browser and then the first thing you think is, what is all that stuff?
Yeah, exactly. And starting from a minimal core is one good motivation for making the system very modular so that you have a clear answer to the what next question.
So now I'm kind of wondering, is the eventual goal to have a giant worldwide image, like one image that's spread across the planet, or are they meant to be singular cells that communicate, as in a single running Spoon instance effectively is an object?
It's more like the latter, yeah. I want to create a large peer-to-peer system so that every cell in there still has its own identity, mostly associated with the identity of the person using it, or teams. As opposed to one big space all the time. I mean, at least until it gets a lot faster. I haven't done any real serious experiments with shared memory or anything like that for remote messaging. So yeah, for now it's more the latter.
Are you working on top of the Squeak system, or are you just using Squeak as a simulator for this?
I'm using Squeak as the basis for it. Yeah, I'm sort of morphing Squeak into something else.
Okay.
So has your work always been in Squeak? Have you tried other versions of Smalltalk?
Well, when I was at Park Place, I, you know, started off with VisualWorks.
Well, clearly, but with the small memory footprint, the small image.
Oh yeah, I'm sort of starting off in Squeak, and I hope to bring the ideas to other Smalltalks also. I've been working with Alan Lovejoy on moving some of these ideas to VisualWorks and GNU Smalltalk and Dolphin.
I mean, you've got a point here on your list of things to talk about, which is fascinating to me. I've always wondered about it because it relates heavily to version control systems and distributed objects, etc., which is the coordination problem. How do you identify things, and how do you know that these two things are the same, especially when one cell makes an object and another cell makes an object, and you really want those two objects to be the same object, things like that. And I guess that's a bit easier if you're talking about code, but when you progress beyond code to artifacts, you want to interact with code, things like that. So I was just wondering how you've been working to solve the problem of object identity. I mean, I can see, I'd like you to talk roughly about how you've done identity for code artifacts like classes and methods, etc., but also how you do it for non-code artifacts that are used by code, such as, you know, some variable in a class instance variable or things like that.
Well, I guess the system I've come up with so far relies fairly heavily on UUIDs to distinguish things which are different. And then higher levels of a messaging protocol to actually say, no, these things are the same. So things sort of start off being assumed to be unique, and you sort of tell participating systems that things are the same later if
how?
They are.
I mean, that's really fascinating to me. How do you have one system then say another system is the same? Does it have like N UUIDs per object?
No. Well, I mean, you can save multiple versions of the same thing. And as far as the underlying system is concerned, those are different things. But for example, a behavior will have one UUID, and you can save multiple versions of it. There's a concept in the module system for Spoon called a behavior ID, which incorporates both its base UUID and a bunch of other information like version and UUID for the author and so forth.
So
and you can use those to describe different versions of a single behavior by different people, for example.
So you can literally have two versions of string in the one image?
Yeah, exactly. That's one interesting thing about Spoon is that there is no system dictionary, for example, and the names of classes aren't important to the system, although, you know, it's important to have tools that can help human beings distinguish what is what. But yeah, when you want to look up a behavior, it's generally done by a behavior ID instead of by name.
I'm still kind of confused when you said that you could say that two things are the same. So if you have three running Spoon programs and A and B program connect together and say these two objects are the same. So they've each got their own unique UUID, and then somehow you bridge them and say, no, they're the same object. And then systems B and C communicate, and they then take their two unique UIDs and say, yep, they're the same. Then if systems A and C communicate, will they automatically know that they're actually talking about the same object?
Well, in the case of behaviors, you want to consider where those systems got those behaviors in the first place. And so usually when people get the system, they'll all be getting it from a common upstream source, at least at some point, which will have already assigned a base UUID to string, for example. The way change management is done in Spoon, there's another, for every object memory that you're actually working in, there's another small one, sort of listening to everything that you do and keeping track of all the changes you make to behavior. So for example, if you add an instance variable to some behavior, then it will log a record for the new behavior that you've made. And it'll have the same base ID as the first one that was in there. So that later when your system has, you know, evolved, say these systems A, B, and C have all evolved, they'll all have these changed, you know, logging systems listening, so that you can ask any particular behavior for its behavior ID, and the base UID will be in there, and they will match because all those object memories originally came from a single one that had that the ID for that behavior already assigned.
So it's a very interesting thing. I mean, we could, I would be talking about this for the next hour and a half if we could. So maybe we should move on to another bit of Spoon.
This is a real, it's sad that it's such a complicated topic, and that sort of made bootstrapping the system into something usable fairly difficult, because it does require a lot of thought.
Yeah. It's very impressive.
But the interesting thing is about the way you're going about this is that ultimately, as you move forward with this, building a program in Spoon is going to be more akin to building a program in most of your traditional systems. You're building up instead of the classic Smalltalk thing of building an image and then figuring out what can be removed from it, which is always the difficult part it's difficult to explain to people why it's necessary. And then it's actually difficult to just do, because you have the problem of either removing too much and having it break, or not removing enough and having it be a little bigger than you'd like it to be.
Right. So, but I guess the upshot of this, all this UUID stuff, is that two systems will be able to exchange behavior by directly transferring it, and not having to rely on source code, where, you know, as in source code, you would say, you know, if you wanted to talk about the class string, you would just use the word string, and that doesn't give any cue as to, well, which version of which author's implementation of string are you talking about. So what I'm just trying to do is at all times record enough information so that you can always be certain of which exact object you're talking about. I'm trying to keep name distinct from identity, object identity.
So what that would allow you to do, though, in Smalltalk, it seems to me as an application developer that what you're going to end up getting to is the ability to have one or more libraries or one or more versions of the same library in memory at the same time. So if you had a program that needed, say, version 1 of a library that handled HTTP, and you could also have version 1.1 of that library in memory, and the two would not conflict with each other, even though in a typical VisualWorks sense now, if they would both be in the same namespace, in your system that wouldn't be a problem.
Right. One thing I like to say is that this is sort of a degenerate case. It effectively gives, it removes all constraints on each class on what its name is, so every class effectively has its own namespace.
So that then begs the question, how do you upgrade? So I've been using string version 1 for the last 2 years, and I want to upgrade to string version 2. How do you do that?
Yeah, so what I have in mind for that is putting every system into a relay network, somewhat like IRC, I suppose, or perhaps like BitTorrent, although I haven't looked too deeply at how BitTorrent works yet, where you can do a discovery of what other systems have joined the network and query them as to what modules they have available for synchronization with your system.
That is kind of heading towards the Uber image in many respects.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I do think you could achieve that, you know, single image incorporating everything idea if you wanted to. I'm just not sure how fast it would be for anything general purpose, as opposed to just doing, you know, behavior updates. But I sort of want to bootstrap this whole thing by tying it into the web a bit, by having module serving systems be able to also run web servers that can be crawled by, you know, various spiders, by Google or whatever. And I have this notion of of a special URL that encodes within it the a way to reach a machine that a module serving system is running on, and a way to identify a particular module, so that when someone, you know, invokes that URL, it will get their system and the providing system to, you know, synchronize each other with regard to that module. There's a tiny example of that on the Spoon site, and I can put a link to that in the chat we have going, text chat on Skype.
Yeah, if you do that, I'll put that in the notes.
So I remember one thing that I thought was interesting about Spoon, well, squat years ago, was the idea of having behavioral slots so that you could incrementally download the compiled behavior off the source of the behavior. So you'd basically be able to call a message, and if that message didn't exist in your image yet, it would go and fetch it.
Yeah, that's one example of this thing I'm calling imprinting. I guess, what I'm calling passive imprinting. I'm using the words passive and active from the point of view of the system providing the behavior. If two systems are have a remote messaging connection between them, then yeah, with passive imprinting, a system can come along, encounter a message it doesn't understand, and instead of trying to appeal to the user, which, you know, may be impossible, like if the system is headless or whatever, it can instead request the missing method from, yeah, some master system, and swap it in inline and then continue from that point, so that there's just a bit of a delay, but other than that, the system just keeps going. And then the active imprinting is imprinting methods onto a target from a providing system, just as a side effect of running the behavior in the providing system. So that might be interesting, like at a show, a trade show or something, if you're giving a demo, all the people attending might, you know, establish a connection with the presenter's object memory before they start. And as they run things like unit tests or whatever, that behavior could be imprinted onto the systems of everyone listening.
Well, I could definitely see that being an interesting demo, because along in a simpler fashion, a couple of years ago at Smalltalk Solutions, one of our guys, Martin Kubetic, did a grid demo where he took using OpenTalk and passed in a peer-to-peer fashion code down to each client so that they could all collectively work on doing some cryptographic breaking. So it seems to me that what you're talking about here would be kind of an even lighter weight version of that, being able to pass that information around with smaller images and smaller amounts of data being pushed around.
Right, right. So, and there, you know, a lot of interesting little challenges in getting that to work right. Like, how do you actually transfer a method correctly from one place to another live? You know, especially when it comes to the method literals, you have to make sure that the behavior in which the method is installed actually exists in the target before you try and put the method over there. And if it doesn't, you have to make sure you install the right version of that behavior in there first. And
right.
So I've got some pretty interesting stress tests of all this. I've been able to imprint exception handling, for example, onto a target that didn't have it before.
And wouldn't the ordering of the loading make a difference as well? That you have to have certain methods before you have certain other methods for the system to work?
Yeah, exactly. So you have to be careful that for things like if you transfer a method to some target, which is actually, you know, an override of some method in some superclass, you have to, allow for that possibility. And the way I do that is if the providing system can detect that the method it's transferring is an override, it transfers a method placeholder to the corresponding superclass in the target, so that if that ever gets hit later, it will result in that method getting swapped in and the right thing happening.
We'll be back with part two of this exchange with Craig Latta next week.
And here's Dave Buck with this week's Cimbron Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. Developers will often create a specific method by copying a general one. Suppose you write a general method which takes a number of parameters. Then you write a more specific method which copies the code from the general method but hard codes some of the parameters. For example, a creation method for rectangles may take an origin point, a width, and a height. Then another method may create squares and only takes the origin point and width. To do this, it copies the code to create rectangles, but substitutes width wherever the original code used height. This technique causes duplication of code and causes maintenance problems. Instead, have the more specific method call the general method with the appropriate parameters. Have the square method call create rectangle with the right parameters and have only one method do the real work. This has been the Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
And here's James Savage with this week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. Brusenel, our contributor in the EU, reports that in Paris, France, Syncom has a long-term position for a French-speaking Smalltalker who has experience with Visual Smalltalk Enterprise. Back in the U.S., Northbrook, Illinois, Global Associates has a 9-month contract for an Agile mentor lead who has experience with Agile software development, Java, Smalltalk, WebSphere, and .NET. Ann Arbor, Michigan. Aerotech Automotive is looking for a product engineer who has a Bachelor of Science degree in computer science and experience with C#, C++, embedded software, Microsoft Windows, Smalltalk, and Visual Studio. This is a permanent position. Concord, California. Cha Tech Incorporated is looking for a Smalltalk developer who also has experience with C++, Java, mainframes, Object Studio, Visual Age, Visual Works, and web services. This is a 6-plus-month contract. These are just a few examples of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
And that about wraps it up for part one of our 2-part episode with Craig Latta. Come back next week for part two. In the meantime, send any feedback to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com or head on over to Facebook, Podcast Alley, iTunes, or the Smalltalkers group on Ning, or the Industry Misinterpretations group on Facebook, to be particular, and we'll see you then. In the meantime, have fun with Smalltalk.
About the things you've been putting me through now. I gotta talk to you, I gotta be explained to you.